turn your tax refund into a new kitchen with Menards. Make this the year you check that project off the list. Renovate your space with new cabinets from Cardell. They're ready to install and come in a variety of styles and finishes with free shipping to your home. Visit our kitchen showrooms in-store or go to Menards.com for free estimates today. Plus, check out our weekly flyer for all of our hot deals going on now. Save big
money at Menards. Hey, I'm Steph.
I'm Alex.
And this is Not Today.
And we're live.
Hey.
How are you?
I'm okay.
That's good.
Yeah, I'm just okay. I am a tad under the weather.
Oh, no.
But the show must go on.
It must.
So sorry about that. If my voice sounds a little bit different, that's why. But, you know.
It doesn't sound different to me.
Tis the season. Well, that's good.
Tis the season.
A little bit congested.
Yeah.
You know, when you're around children, they tend to be a little sickly sometimes.
They do that.
Yeah.
And, you know, They sneeze as they please.
And they cough in your face.
Yeah.
And also on their birthday
cake.
Kind of
just into the air.
Yep.
But what are you going to do? They're cute.
They're very cute.
You know, they don't know. They do know, but they just forget, you know?
And that's okay.
But we are in, I'm kind of tripped out because we're in a new recording space.
We are.
That you're going to repurpose for another project, yet unknown. But still exciting.
Very exciting.
So it is kind of cool. We're in our basement, but I don't know. It's been a while since we've moved spots.
Yeah, we've got like lights and stuff. It's looking
good.
And
decor.
Yes, and decor. If that's a little sneak, little hint for you. But yeah, I mean, we're working on some stuff and I'm excited about it. So.
Well, when you say we, you mean you.
I do mean me. Yes.
I am not doing any work.
I'm working on some stuff, but.
Yeah, I will not be taking any credit.
Yes, I'm working on some stuff. I'm hoping to have that up and running in a little bit.
In soon.
Yes, in coming soon.
So what are we doing today? What are we getting into?
Yeah, today we're going to be talking about some brothers who went on a hiking trip that unfortunately went quite wrong. So you want to jump into that?
I do.
Okay. In early March of 2011, 56-year-old college administrator David Ciccatello and his brother, 70-year-old Louis Ciccatello, were taking a climbing trip together through southeastern Utah, which was something they loved to do. David said for him, the climbing trips were as much about bonding with his older brother Louis as they were about actually climbing. Louis was 13 years older than David. He had started college when David was still in kindergarten. So he was always a mentor figure to David. By the time David went off to college, Louis had so much life experience and was someone David really looked up to. Louis was an art professor at that time and in his early 30s, and David said he felt like he grew up a lot with him because he was such a big influence on him. Louis introduced him to Asian food for the first time, he brought him to his first Grateful Dead concert, and he ultimately became his climbing teacher. But it was more than that. Louis was David's guide throughout his life. After the initial period of bonding when David first went to college, the two drifted apart for a time. David went off to become an English teacher, first in Nebraska and then in Tennessee. And Louis lived hundreds of miles away in Colorado. But then after years apart doing their own thing, the pair reconnected. They both had the shared interest in exploring nature and climbing in the Southwest, specifically in Utah, Arizona, and Colorado. Louis had been an experienced climber for years, and he suggested that David should learn as well, and could potentially be a fun thing they do together. He said it was the only way they'd be able to properly explore the areas they were interested in, and Louis could teach David along the way. It didn't take much convincing for David to be on board with this idea. He was always happy to have another excuse to spend quality time with his brother. So he technically learned how to climb and got certified in a gym, but then actually learned how to climb out in nature with Louis and got the real world experience with him.
The real certification.
Yes. Louis was his mentor out in the field and got him confident and comfortable on the rope, which was another bonding period for them. And David loved it. It made him feel like a kid again. Sure, they were a little older now, but it was like old times. Even at 70, Lewis still kept David on his toes. And once Lewis felt like David was ready, they were helping each other scale and descend rock faces.
I'm going to be honest, this sounds like the description of a Hallmark movie premise.
Yeah, it's pretty wholesome.
Right? It's like, he still keeps him on his toes all these years later, and they were on to another adventure.
They were, know? Yeah. It's very, very sweet. They would take climbing trips as often as they could, which was typically around once a year, or sometimes more, if they were lucky. They would spend a week camping, hiking, and technical climbing in the canyons of southeastern Utah. And on that trip in 2011, they were going to be hiking together through No Man's Canyon, which was a slot canyon, in the fabled Robber's Roost area of southeastern Utah.
Fabled?
Yes.
That's a fun one.
Yes, it's
Why
got
is it fabled?
Some history. Well, I'm going to tell you. But David and Lewis set out that morning around 9 a.m. on Sunday, March 6th. Their plan was to do a six-hour hike, entering through the North Fork of the canyon, rappelling all the way down. Then they would hike up the Old Horse Trail back to the rim, which was where their truck was, so they could go to their next campsite. When they reached the trailhead, they spotted only two sets of footprints, which were their own from the day before when they came to scout the area. That meant no one else had been up there, and they were completely alone, which in these parts was not completely unexpected. This area was extremely remote. The remoteness is what drew climbers and hikers to the area. And this part of Utah has a lot of history. It's known as Robber's Roost because back in the 19th century, outlaws would go into these canyons to evade the law. It was a place where cowboys didn't even want to go. Butch Cassidy and his gang were known to frequent these canyons, and since most of the canyons are slot canyons, which are very narrow in places, they would basically just go in there to get lost.
So they're dangerous and fun.
Yeah. I mean, if you're a climber and you know how to navigate them, then yeah, it's a lot of fun. But for people who don't know how to get around a slot canyon, could be very dangerous.
Well, it beats getting caught by the law.
Right. For the outlaws.
You know?
It was a great place. In many places, you have to shimmy up narrow areas and then climb down to get over obstacles. And it's an area that requires a lot of problem solving and very technical climbing. So for climbers, this place is kind of like a theme park. And for outlaws back in the day, it was a place that you could very easily stay hidden if you wanted to. But David and Lewis had every intention of staying visible and easy to find. They were not new to taking adventures together out in nature, and they had taken every precaution to stay as safe as possible. For starters, they had given a map with their intended routes and destinations, as well as arrival times and departure times, to David's partner Rhonda, and Lewis gave one to his wife Millie. So every step of the way, they would know where the men were and that they would be home by Friday.
They're not messing around.
Yeah.
And I would never expect someone named Rhonda to fuck around.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah. Rhonda knows what's up. She knows exactly where they're going to be on every single day and what time they're supposed to leave.
And she's even microchipped both of them.
Yeah. That would have been very helpful at this point. But yeah, the men were also climbing together, which was another layer of safety.
True. I mean, could you imagine that's how you find out?
Microchipped?
No, you get lost and then she finds you. And you're like, okay, this was
a little too easy for
this
you.
This was not great, right. But, you know.
Maybe, I wonder if people could utilize AirTags.
Probably. I mean, do you need cell service for it to work?
I'm not sure the technology or what's required for it, but I just know that it gives you a GPS location of whatever you have it on or whatever. I know that like parents will put an AirTag like on their kid. Like if they're on a toddler, they have like little AirTag holders and you can like put it on your toddler's shoe so you don't lose your kid, which is a pretty good use. And yeah, also you put it on like your keys or like other things like that.
Yeah,
but
we're probably going to do that. But
right.
I assume it feels like less Black Mirror-esque of like putting it under somebody's skin.
Well, yeah, I think microchipping is a bit much, but I think slipping an AirTag into someone's bag. I mean, it would be better if they knew about it, right? But it could be a good tool. You know, if you're going to give someone a map to be like, here's this map for safety purposes, if that did work, you know?
Yeah.
That could be a cool thing. But anyway, they didn't have that, obviously. They didn't have an AirTag. They didn't have anything other than a map. But
what year is this?
2011. As far as like the precautions go, they took every precaution they could to be as safe as possible. Because they knew how important their preparation was. Robber's Roost is nearly 3,000 square miles of desert cut by sandstone slot canyons. And there was a lot that could go wrong. Flash floods were a major concern in slot canyons. Rock falls, scorpion stings, and even though their loved ones knew where they were, the remoteness made things extremely dangerous. Even a minor injury out there could become fatal since help would be days away. But regardless of all of that, the men were really looking forward to their trip, and they weren't necessarily concerned because they did trips like this frequently. So it was about midday, and David and Lewis were descending into No Man's Canyon. They were in the middle of a two-stage rappel, the first part being about 40 feet down to a ledge, and then the second part was about 100 feet down to a dry creek bed on the bottom. And this is actually the canyon's main feature. This is the final 100-foot descent to the bottom. And Lewis went first, rappelling down to the small sloping edge. This part of the climb slopes down about 20 feet to the edge, and then it drops. But in that place, it's very narrow, and only one climber can go down at a time, so they couldn't go down together, or even stand together at the edge. Lewis was definitely a more experienced climber than David. He had been through a series of the 14ers in Colorado, which are mountains in Colorado exceeding 14,000 feet, and he had been with climbers who were getting ready to climb Everest, so he had plenty of practice. And on their trips, he typically took the lead and had a very specific system for setting up the rappels and the climbs and everything. By that point, David had about 6 or 7 years of climbing under his belt with his brother, so he knew Lewis's rituals of what he expected and how things were going to go. And he was fine with that. One of Lewis's biggest rules was that the most experienced climber goes first. He rarely let David go first on a climb. There were a few occasions when he would, but this was not one of those times. David's job at that point was just to assist Lewis in setting up the rope for the rappel. They would be using a 200-foot rope for the 100-foot rappel, which was double-sided through a rappel ring. So there were two strands on either side that had to be equally placed so they were the same length. As they thread the rope through the rappel ring, they were looking for a piece of white tape that Lewis had placed at the center of the rope so they knew that each side would be equal. Once they found that piece of white tape, they knew that they would be ready to begin the rappel. The guys only had the one 200-foot rope for the 100-foot rappel with them, but that was the length they needed for that descent, because the rule is you need double the length of rope for the height of the rappel. So even though it was enough rope, it was just enough. Ideally, the rope would be longer than that to allow some margin of error, but that was the rope they had for the day, and in theory, it was good.
I mean, did they know how long or how far down each rappel was in their path, or did they just like pick a big number?
Oh, of course they knew. Yeah.
Okay.
They planned this trip out before they went.
Okay. I just didn't know if it told you how far down it was or not.
Yeah. I mean, these are hikes that are well established before these guys got there.
Gotcha.
Yeah. They aren't like exploring and like finding a new route. This is just a hike. So they knew what they were getting themselves into.
Right. Well, good luck getting it exactly halfway.
Yeah. I mean, in theory, it should have been because they set it up to have the white tape in the middle, but...
You're really setting it up.
Right. So Lewis tied in, and working his way down the sloped area to the edge, he began descending first. David was about 20 feet back, watching his brother go down the little slope to the edge, and then he went over the edge and started to go down. And David caught a final glimpse of Lewis as he went over the edge before he slid out of view. So how this rappel worked was, it was obviously very narrow, as I've said, and only one person could do it at a time, but David couldn't see Lewis as he was going down either. Like, he had to be pretty far back. So once Lewis went over the edge, he couldn't see Lewis anymore.
Spooky.
Yeah. All David could see at that point was the rope around the anchor, as taut as it could be, over the edge. And he watched the rope snake through the rappel ring. The first thing Lewis said to David was, "It goes fast." which it did because it was a free rappel, meaning their feet would not be touching the canyon wall as they went down. They would just be dangling in the air. So they're just dangling in the air 100 feet above the ground and just rappelling. A few seconds went by, and the next thing David heard Lewis say was, "Oops, the rope is short." Unfortunately, that piece of white tape wasn't actually in the center of the rope, and it was later figured out the reason it wasn't was they had pulled that rope through four previous rappels in that canyon, so the tape had shifted during the other use.
Ah.
Yeah.
Perhaps a Sharpie may have been more effective.
Yeah, maybe, but they didn't realize at the time. So
damn.
Lewis must have looked down to see the strands were dangling beneath him and noticed they weren't equal, which is when he called back to David and let him know that they weren't even. And David was still in the slot canyon and his brother was out of sight, actively rappelling. So when he heard his brother say, "Oops, the rope is short," he froze and his stomach dropped. Because he couldn't look down to watch him descend, all he could do was watch the rope. He had no idea how high above the ground Lewis still was. But the next thing he heard Lewis say was, "No biggie." When David heard "no biggie," he felt relieved, because he assumed Lewis had the situation under control, so he relaxed a little bit. But only seconds later, before he could even really process what was happening, David saw the rope zip through the rappel ring and go over the edge completely, which was when he knew that both his brother and the rope had gone down, which happened in a matter of 3 seconds. David immediately knew what had happened, so he screamed his brother's name, but he got no reply. From David's vantage point, he didn't hear him land hard, but he also didn't hear Lewis cry out at all, and all of his calls to him were going unanswered. He said had Lewis made a sound, he would have been able to hear him because there are really good acoustics in the slot canyon. David's heart hammered in his chest as he stood there frozen, unsure of what to do, knowing there really wasn't anything he could do. All he heard was the deafening silence of the desert, the wind whipping through the canyon. Questions raced through his mind. Why hadn't Lewis made a sound? What went wrong? What was he going to do? Instinctively, he tried to inch forward toward the edge to try to spot Lewis, but then he froze. The 200-foot rope that fell with Lewis was their only climbing rope. The only one he had now was a 20-foot static rope for setting anchors or backups, but far too short to descend with. So since descending would be impossible, his next thought was to try climbing out the way they came in, which was only about 40 feet back up. However, they had rappelled down, so it wouldn't be an easy climb. There was an overhanging shelf of sandstone jutting out from the rock about 10 feet above him, and climbing over that without proper rope or equipment would be impossible. And David had hiking boots on, which wouldn't be the proper footwear to make that sort of climb work. He couldn't get any traction on the slick rock to boost himself up. He would have needed climbing equipment to use his static rope to throw over the mantle to climb over it to get himself out the way he came in, so there was no way he would be able to climb out. Had he made it to the rim, he would have attempted to hike back down around to the exit to try to find his brother, but that wouldn't be possible, so he was stuck where he was. And there was zero cell service, and I don't even think he had his phone. I'm pretty sure it was back in his truck anyway, so he couldn't call for help.
God. So, okay, he can't go back up because they've climbed down already.
Yep.
With the longer rope. And why can't he even like go look over the edge?
Because if he gets too close to the edge, he is risking falling and it's a 100 foot fall.
Like, is it a 90 degree ledge or is it like something else?
Yeah, it's a really narrow area and it's just a complete drop off edge. So he didn't want to risk going anywhere near that because it was extremely dangerous.
Okay.
And there was no way for him to get down from there. So
if it's just a ledge, I don't understand why it's so dangerous to just like go look over.
I could pull up a picture.
Yeah. Oh, okay. So it's like it's a free fall, but to get through the free fall, like you have to go down a pretty steep like slide.
Yeah, it was like a 20-foot sloped
Jesus.
Ledge to get to the free fall.
Okay, so that's why he's not looking over.
Yeah, like there was no way for him to get there safely and then get back up kind of thing. I mean, maybe, but he didn't want to risk it.
Yeah, well, if you can't get back up, you're really screwed.
Right.
Well, I mean, what the fuck do you do?
Nothing. He couldn't do anything.
I guess you just sit there and pray.
Yeah, that was kind of all he could do at this point.
Yeah, I mean, I guess how far off was the tape? Was it like 50 feet or was it like 10?
Well, we don't know the exact amount, but we'll get into that later. So, although David was stuck where he was, he recalled something he learned in Boy Scouts, which was when you get lost out in the wilderness, the best thing for you to do is to stay put. Trying to find your way back could risk getting you into deeper trouble. Your best bet of being found is by staying where you are. That did mean he'd have to give up on attempting to get to Lewis, but it wasn't like he had much of a choice at that point anyway, so that thought of staying put was really just for comfort. This was somewhere around 1 o'clock in the afternoon. David himself didn't wear a watch, but Lewis did. And just before they began the rappel, he had looked at his watch and said, "It's 1 o'clock, let's go down and have our lunch." So that was the last time David would know a fixed time on the clock for quite some time. Within a few minutes of making the decision that he'd have to wait out rescue, he heard Lewis moan from below, which was the only time he heard any audible sound from his brother. David immediately rushed to the slot opening and called out Lewis's name again, hoping to get a response from him or have a conversation with him, but the sound stopped. David tried to crane his neck to see past the sloping edge of the wall, but if he got any closer to the drop, he would risk falling himself. He called out again and again for Lewis, but still, no response. At that point, he thought it was probably somewhere around 3 o'clock, and he knew it was time to focus on his survival. He opened his backpack and emptied it out onto the ledge to see everything he had in front of him. The plan was for David and Lewis to camp in the desert until Friday, which was 5 days from then. But they intended on returning to their camp that night, which meant David only had enough food and water on him for the hike they had planned that afternoon. He had only packed lunch, not even a dinner, because they figured by dinner time they would be back at camp. He deconstructed his lunch and decided he was going to ration his sandwich, his orange, his power bar, and his trail mix. He had a 16-ounce bottle of water and a liter of iced tea that he had put a large slice of lemon in because he liked lemon in his iced tea. He believed he should have just enough rations to make it through the next 4 days. It would be difficult, both physically and mentally, however, it should be doable as long as nothing went wrong. It had only been a few hours, and yet he already wanted to drink the contents of his water, but he had to be careful. He took inventory of his supplies and laid everything out on the rock. He had some metal clips, a roll of climbing tape, his penknife, and some spare clothes. He then ripped apart the backpack itself and tore out the styrofoam padding and put it alongside the rest of the gear. It wasn't much, but he'd have to make it work. Even though David was in a slot canyon, the sun still shone down into the crack and beat down on him. So he nestled himself underneath the sandstone overhang, which offered some shade and protection from the elements. He had almost like a little cavern area. It was still dry at that point, but a sudden rainstorm wasn't out of the question. If there was going to be rain, the overhang would shield him from that from the most part, but flash floods were always a concern. So he placed his empty backpack at the rear of the ledge underneath the overhang and laid down. He looked up at the sky and then closed his eyes. He focused all of his energy on the mantra, "Get to Friday, get to Friday." He thought that would be the earliest day of his rescue, because their trip was supposed to go until Thursday night, and when their loved ones didn't get a call from them on Thursday night, they would act. Because he had that goal in mind, he felt some sense of calm. He got into the ritual at night of meditation. He'd think of his loved ones, which was comforting and also tough. One of the reasons they had to get out of the canyon on Friday was because Lewis's wife Millie was retiring from teaching, and there was going to be a retirement party in Colorado Springs for her. David knew that on Friday, instead of having a celebration for her, she'd actually probably be learning that her husband had passed away. So it would be a day full of grief and despair, and she didn't know that yet. He was the only one that did. But he couldn't think about that. He had to push down any feelings of grief or sadness or helplessness to get through this. He couldn't focus on Lewis, because if he did, it would kill him. As night fell in the desert, the temperature plummeted. The wind whistled down the canyon. They had only dressed for a day hike, so David had only a few layers of hiking clothing on. He pulled on a pair of woolen climbing pants and rolled up a spare pair of socks and tucked them underneath his hat as makeshift earmuffs. Thankfully, he had those in case they had encountered any water in the canyon. He could have changed his socks if that had happened, but now they were earmuffs. In this part of Utah, the daytime heat can be misleading. Despite being a desert, this area sits at a very high elevation. Once the sun goes down, the temperature plummets. The temperature forecast that week was perfect for their trip. It was going to be in the mid-60s and sunny during the day, which was great for hiking, but at night it would be freezing, or in the 20s, Fahrenheit. David tried to get as creative as possible to keep himself warm at night. He took the styrofoam padding from his backpack and shoved it under his shirt for one extra layer, and then wrapped his arms around his chest to try to get some sleep.
Dude, 20 degrees is cold.
Yeah. And it's like in a slot canyon. I have to imagine that's got to be even colder.
Yeah. And it's like, what, 80 during the day?
It was supposed to be like 60s.
That's really crazy.
Yeah.
I guess for a desert, like, it's not that uncommon for that type of temperature fluctuation. It's just really hard for me to imagine what 20 degrees in a desert is like.
Yeah. Cold.
Cold.
It's cold.
Cold and windy.
Yeah.
Miserable. And on top of it all, dry.
Yeah, it's a dry cold.
Yeah, I'm like, even if it snowed, it would be better because snow is insulating.
Yeah, no, he didn't have that. He just had his socks, his earmuffs, and some styrofoam that he put under his shirt. This was a hellish experience, but David had been through hell before. A few years earlier, he had suffered a devastating loss. His son tragically lost his battle with brain cancer at only 30. That moment in his life almost prepared him for this situation. It made him more resilient. He had gotten through that, and now he would get through this. After a sleepless night, David's first full day in the canyon went by painfully slow. His hunger grew as the hours passed. That evening, he managed to scrounge together some scraps of paper from his backpack and burn them to keep his fingers warm. He sat there on the rock with his hands outstretched over this tiny campfire when he felt one single drop of rain.
Oh no.
The thought of rain in the canyon was a terrifying one. Flash floods in a slot canyon are extremely dangerous. Rapid onset torrents caused by rain, often occurring miles away, can fill narrow passages with water and debris in minutes, making them fatal. Because, I mean, these canyons are super narrow, and they fill up, I guess, pretty quickly, and they just rush through.
Yeah, well, I mean, any water along the whole canyon just gets funneled into a few feet.
Right. I mean, that's how slot canyons are formed, is from the rain and from water. So I guess it's just like, that's how it works. But it's also extremely dangerous for any person who's in there. So it was definitely a concern for that to happen. And David said, quote, "The physicality of heat and cold over time makes sandstone fragile. And if there's enough hard rain coming down, it can also loosen up rock. It's already fragile from the thawing and the baking, and Monday night started to rain." The rain started slowly, but within moments it really picked up. So he pressed himself up against the rock underneath the overhang and brought his legs up against his chest to stay as dry as possible. He looked up to the top of the canyon wall where the rain was hammering down, and despite the cover he had from the overhang, he quickly became soaked from the torrential downpour. As he tried to get some rest, he heard an even worse sound. Rocks had begun coming down. He once again scrambled as far back as he could, desperately searching for any cover from falling rocks. He didn't know if it was just fragments or if it was going to be a big rock slide that would come down, and he was even more terrified than he had ever been before. Rocks flew past him in the darkness with the rain, and then the rocks that were hitting the ledge that he was on were starting to break apart and come toward him, so they were like hitting the ledge and kind of exploding at him because they were so fragile. So David had to cover his head with his arms to avoid getting any bits of rock debris that turned into basically projectiles into his eyes. And he sat there like that, hoping and praying that a bigger rock fall wasn't on its way.
Yeah, I mean, I can't really imagine more of a helpless situation.
Yeah, right.
Maybe it will flash flood, maybe not. And it's definitely rock falling, but also maybe it will become bigger rocks. I don't know. Dude.
Rock slide?
What even is a rock slide?
Just like basically raining rocks.
A flash flood of rocks?
Yes.
This is an unforgiving terrain.
Extremely. And there's nowhere he can go. He's literally just stuck pressed up against this like wall, trying to shield himself from the rain, the rocks. But there, he doesn't have much cover. It's really scary.
I know. Well, I'm thinking about the people who do slot canyons. It's kind of like if you get stuck at the wrong point, you're just really SOL.
Yeah. It's a dangerous hobby to get into, but
yeah,
for people who like it, it's also really cool.
It sounds really cool, but yeah, I feel like my pack would be like 100 pounds.
Oh my God.
I'm bringing like 5 days of food, 3 ropes.
My claustrophobic ass? Could you imagine?
No.
I hate that shit.
No.
I mean, I like looking at pictures of them. I think it's really cool to see, but...
You'd go from the top, drop a GoPro down.
Sure.
And then come back up.
Yeah, I would like to watch like someone go through a slot canyon, maybe on YouTube.
Right.
And then I've had my fix. But anyway, eventually the rain got lighter, thankfully, and the rocks also stopped coming down and David dozed off. So nothing terrible happened and he was able to get some sleep, which is good.
Yeah, like what's... Just thinking of counting sheep after that is hilarious.
Right.
And 20 degrees again, wet.
Yeah.
Ugh.
In another world, that puts you to sleep, right?
Very calming.
I love rain sounds to put me to sleep, but not there.
Not rock sounds.
Not rock fall sounds. I don't like that. The next morning, he opened his eyes to see the sun shining and the blue sky above him, which is just like, come on. Like, I mean, that's great that happened. But
right.
Like, after a night like that, you just open your eyes and you're like, Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
Like,
I know. It's for all the stories we tell where somebody is stranded somewhere, like, incredibly harsh, but just stunningly beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the great ironies is, you know, how beautiful it is and how, like, desperate of a situation you're in at the same time.
Yeah. It's got to be one of those times. It's a beautiful place, but I don't think you could be in a more desperate situation. David still had a few days to wait before he knew their family would sound the alarm for them. But in the meantime, he decided to use his time by trying to make himself more visible. He looked around at the items scattered around the ledge, and he landed on a sheet of stiff plastic pulled from the inside of his backpack, and then the webbing pockets of the exterior part of his pack. He started to think maybe he might be able to use it to make a help sign. So he used the webbing to make the letters H and E, and then he realized he shouldn't be using his time to cut the webbing, so he took out his climber's tape and made the L and the P. He then laid the sign out flat on the sloping ledge and held it in place with a few rocks. This ravine was one of hundreds in the area, so the odds of anyone spotting him down there were pretty slim, but he had to try. So he sat on his empty backpack and just waited.
Well, they know their route, right?
They do, but at this point, I mean, it's not Friday yet, so his family don't know that they're missing.
Right.
So there's no search happening. Although the days were tedious and boring, he said he became very engaged with his surroundings. He watched the skyline and the ravens that flew by. He watched day turn to dusk, and at night, he watched the constellations as they would move across the sky. And by doing that, he could somewhat keep track of time. The Orion constellation specifically was his favorite because the belt of it would move across the sky from left to right, and he knew that time was passing in the evening by watching it, so at least he could do something. The other thing he decided to do was make a slash on the rock face for each day that went by so he could keep track of the days, and he also carved his name into the canyon wall, but he didn't do it all at once. He would carve a letter or two at a time because he wanted to give himself something to do later on.
You're saving the letter for later.
Yeah. Yeah, he starts with just like DA, you know, then like 4 hours later, I guess I'll do the V.
It's my treat.
Oh boy.
I know.
It's a little treat.
Yeah, wow. It's the way he's managing his mentality is super interesting.
Uh-huh. He also figured out that he could scoop up some sand and put it in a small utility bag to make a little pillow out of it. And one day while he was scooping up the sand, he started to sing. Later in therapy, he learned that singing was actually a very comforting thing to do. He wasn't singing constantly, but it was something that he did to pass the time. Lewis had taken his camera because he wanted to take a picture of David coming down the rappel, so he didn't have his camera, and he didn't have his journal with him. So all he could really do was think. And he also prayed a lot and focused all of his energy on getting to Friday. But his rituals were a very big way he got through his time in the canyon. He also knew he had to stay calm. As terrified as he was for Lewis, he knew he couldn't spend the entire time waiting until Friday weeping. He wouldn't be able to make it in that state. He had to get his mind focused on survival and really not think about anything else, because he couldn't. Tuesday turned to Wednesday, which turned into Thursday, and his food rations were getting very low, but thankfully he still had the liter bottle of iced tea, which was his final reserve he held on to for when things got desperate. David believed Thursday was going to be his last day on the ledge, and because of that, he decided he earned a swig of iced tea. When he opened the bottle, he could immediately tell that something was wrong. The lemon in his iced tea had turned brown and black, and he could instantly smell that it had gone rancid. He got so enraged that the lemon had molded in his tea that he tossed the bottle back and forth in his hands, and the tea went everywhere. So he just spilled it all over the place. He threw the empty bottle aside, trembling with frustration. He did still have a few milliliters left in his main water bottle, although he decided not to take a sip, even though he was already battling dehydration. He made a pledge to himself. He wasn't going to drink the rest of that water until he was rescued. That last sip of water was going to be a celebratory sip. Even if he started to hallucinate and was feeling like he was going to pass out, he came to the conclusion that he was just going to let it happen.
Wow. That is so not the way I would have gone.
Yeah.
It's so interesting. And there's like no answer other than like he feels that this is the way, the best way for him to survive.
Yeah. I mean, it was a sip of water. It wasn't going to get him very far anyway.
Right.
And this whole thing was a mind game, you know?
Right.
It is very interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I can't believe some of the stuff he did. Also, what the fuck is the lemon doing molding? Not cool. Also, I thought it's, you know, acidic and whatever. I thought it wouldn't mold while it's in water.
Well, I guess it was in tea, you know? I wonder if it was sugary tea, you know?
Maybe. But I don't know. It just wasn't that long. That's, I mean, I probably would have chucked it over the canyon. I would have been so mad.
Pretty much what he did. Like, yeah. He was pretty pissed at that point. But that day was Thursday. And by that time, David's partner Rhonda and Lewis's wife Millie would have been expecting a call from them telling them that they were on their way home from the trip. Which meant when they didn't hear from him, they would alert authorities and a search and rescue would be sent out. As night fell, David's anticipation and optimism grew. He felt like tomorrow, this horrible nightmare would finally be over. This whole time, all he did was tell himself, get to Friday. But as soon as Friday came, it also went. And by the end of that day, David was extremely upset and worried, because he felt like that was it for him. He lay in the dark, thinking about how his only plan and motivation had been to get to Friday. But now that Friday was gone, he didn't know what was going to keep him going. Before, he had an end to look forward to, but now he had no idea what to expect. And his rations were almost completely gone. He felt like he had been given a death sentence. But then he heard it, the distant whir of a helicopter. It was about 11 p.m. when the Utah State Patrol helicopter came down the canyon and was searching that night. David later found out they had known that he and Lewis were in the North Fork of the canyon because that's where their map said they would have been, and they had found their truck at the trailhead. So David jumped to his feet as the helicopter swooped low in the canyon with its searchlight cutting across the opening. He stood up on the interior ledge and screamed, "I'm here." They of course couldn't hear him, but that was his instinct. The helicopter moved on, but David felt instant relief knowing that they had been searching for them and that they were looking in the right spot. His mood did a complete 180. Now he had all the hope in the world that they would return the next day to search there in the light. All he had to do was wait a few more hours to get to Saturday. And when day did finally break, David heard the helicopter returning. He once again jumped to his feet and went to the edge with his help sign in hand. After about a minute, the helicopter acknowledged that they had seen David by using their horn, and David later found out that they had found him around 1 p.m. that day. So altogether, he spent roughly 144 hours in the canyon, a full 6 days.
That's so long to do nothing.
Yep, to stare at a wall and to try not to think about how terrible this is. A few moments after the helicopter sounded its horn, a search and rescue officer rappelled down to the ledge and asked David what happened. David explained the situation as best he could, the accident, and his 6 days alone in the slot canyon. The officer strapped him into a harness attached to a winch that allowed him to climb past the overhang mantle and out of the canyon. He basically walked up the rock face. Once he made it to the mantle, the rescue guys picked him up over the mantle, and then he was up and out of the slot. Finally. David climbed inside the helicopter where the rescue team assured him they would come back for Lewis. But right now, their main priority was getting him to safety. In the helicopter, David learned that the rescue team that saved him was the same team that rescued Aaron Ralston. Remember him?
Oh yeah. The guy who broke his arm?
He sawed off his arm.
And then sawed it off?
Yep. And he told them in the helicopter that he had out-Ralstoned Ralston.
Well, we'll let him have that in the moment. But
yeah.
You got to saw something off.
Right. He said he needed that moment of lightness in this rescue because he was so happy to be saved and alive, but at the same time, he knew what was coming next, and it was obviously also devastating.
Yeah, Lewis is gone.
At that point, David still didn't know for certain if Lewis was dead or not, but it seemed highly unlikely that he was alive, but he hadn't gotten full confirmation. The helicopter took David back to the trailhead where his car was parked so he could retrieve his cell phone and wallet, and there he learned from a sheriff officially that Lewis had sadly passed. David then got back in the helicopter and went to Moab, where he was admitted to the hospital. He lost 15 pounds in 6 days and had some frostbite on his toes and fingertips. 15 pounds in 6 days.
That's a lot.
Yeah. And also, I know we were talking about how the temperature drops at night, but getting frostbite in the desert is just kind of strange.
Yeah, I mean, that's that's really just a slap in the face.
Yeah.
I mean, he must have lost so much weight because his body was trying to keep warm at night,
sure.
Right?
Yeah. And also he was eating rations of one sandwich for 6 days.
Yeah, well, that too. But, you know, I have to imagine that being really cold didn't help either.
Well, no, definitely not. But now that he was finally safe, the survival mindset that he had kept the entire time he was in the canyon had turned off. And now he had to feel the grief. David's theory for what happened was Lewis was descending on the shorter piece of rope. When he reached the end, he decided to take a leap of faith. When Lewis jumped, the rope must have slipped through the anchor device and fallen with him. They don't know how far the fall was, but upon impact, Lewis broke his pelvis. Though it wasn't a fatal injury, it left him critically incapacitated. He was a type 2 diabetic, and since he couldn't move, he couldn't take his medication, which sent him into a diabetic coma, which is ultimately what killed him.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it's really sad.
The only thing you can hope is that it was quick, but my God, that's pretty gruesome.
It's super sad, but it seems like he was doing what he loved, and he also had a really cool life.
Yeah.
And was an awesome guy, you know? But it is awful. Soon after David was admitted to the emergency room, one of the first things he asked for was a pastor to speak with, because he needed to talk to someone about what he had just been through. The ER doctor told him there wasn't a pastor or anyone to speak to in the hospital, but he was going to check on some things. When he came back 30 minutes later, he told David that they were going to take him to church. There was a 5 o'clock service at the local church, and he brought David a change of clothes from his friend who was a captain for American Airlines. And he used the doctor's shower to clean up, and they drove him to the church without even, like, discharging him. Like, they just snuck him out of the hospital, basically. And at that service, the scripture they were speaking about was Christ in the wilderness. And David had just come out of the wilderness. It felt bigger than him, and he had to talk to the pastor about all the guilt and sadness and fear that he had been pushing down for a week, which he did, and then he came back to the church the next day, and he said that was the beginning of his healing. But I thought that was a really incredible piece of his moment in the hospital, like that the doctor was like, yeah, I'm going to take you to church, you know, because you need this.
And like, I don't know, was it sanctioned by the hospital or was it like Operation Church?
I don't think so. I don't know. I think it was just Operation Pastor. Like it was like, yeah. I'm going to get you my friend's clothes, who's a American Airlines pilot, and you're just going to wear a pilot's clothes and go to the church and talk to the pastor.
I know, but it also feels like it was meant to be.
He needed it.
Well, he definitely needed it, but then the scripture was about Christ in the wilderness. Like,
yeah.
I mean, he works in mysterious ways is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, it was cool. He said it felt bigger than him, and it was definitely the beginning of his healing. He needed that. And after he left the hospital, he went home to Tennessee, where he returned to his teaching job and tried to return to normal life. But his grief began taking over his life. At one point, he became angry at Lewis. He dealt with intrusive thoughts and nightmares. For months, when he would go to sleep, he'd be right back on that ledge. But with the help of his friends, family, therapist, and priest, he began to heal. Lewis's wife, Millie, also wanted to visit the place where Lewis fell for her healing. So she planned a memorial trip to No Man's Canyon 6 months after the event. She organized 11 people and one dog to go to No Man's, and they went and camped where David and Lewis had camped the night before, and they planned to route find the exit and go in that way, because they weren't going to go in through the canyon and rappel down, especially with 11 people and a dog. Their closest friends were all there, and she wanted to place a memorial for Lewis. The route finding was more challenging than they expected, and by 2:30, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, they had to take a beat and come to terms with the fact that it was going to get dark by the time they got down there to where Lewis had been, so they took a moment to see who wanted to be a part of that and who didn't, because it was going to get a little bit dangerous at this point. And David, understandably, did not want to do that. But Millie did. So 7 of them went back with David, and Millie and a few friends went on. And they did make it. Millie placed her memorial, and then they found their way back in the evening. But it was a very pivotal moment for Millie, because before then, she had been dealing with a lot of grief and anger toward David, because she didn't understand why he couldn't get to Lewis. Once she found the spot and saw with her own eyes what they were up against, she understood why David couldn't have done anything. And it was after that that her anger toward David and her hard feelings toward him had dissolved, and she was able to move forward as well. They didn't expect that outcome of the memorial trip, but she and David had a moment back at the camp where they were able to talk and kind of probably cry and heal a little bit. It was also around that time that David got on antidepressants because his doctor told him that he was literally stuck in grief and he needed to fix that. It is a chemical imbalance in your brain, after all, and once he got onto the right medication, he said he felt worlds better, and the nightmares stopped, which was huge for him. David said without what he calls his A-team, meaning, you know, his loved ones, therapist, doctor, and pastor, he wouldn't have made it through. And he wrote a memoir and gives motivational speeches, sharing his message of survival and brotherly love, and he speaks a lot about Lewis and how amazing he was. Lewis was a valedictorian of his high school class. He went to Carnegie Institute of Technology and spoke his mind, which emboldened David to have opinions and speak them confidently. And each time he makes a presentation, it's to honor his brother. And that's their story.
How old was he when he died?
70.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a tragedy. And at the same time, you kind of felt like he got a pretty full life.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
I do. Yeah.
Yeah. He had gotten to live life.
Totally.
It's another thing, like, how big tragedy can be for somebody. Just the amount of work that's required to get over or work through something like this.
Yeah.
And it just never goes away. It just gets, like, I don't know, like, you, it becomes a part of you that you can live with.
And you have to keep evolving in different ways to deal with it. Totally. I really appreciated how open he was with his struggles after everything, with his grief and with the process that he went through, because it's not linear and it's really, really hard. And he said, yeah, like for a time I got angry with Lewis. You know, he was like, why did he leave me? Why did he not check the rope? Or, you know, I don't want to put words in his mouth, but he said, like, it's just, it becomes complicated and hard to deal with. But yeah, like you said, it really does kind of take a village to get someone through something like that. And he had a really good group of people around him. So that was really great. And he also did a lot of work himself to get himself through it. So that was really awesome. And also his time in the canyon was super interesting, like listening to his rituals and his process and everything.
Yeah, I mean, it's like he just knew what he needed. He just, yeah, I mean, the water bottle thing is just what's sticking out to me the most, that he, you know, it's a drop of water. In the grand scheme of things, it doesn't make a difference physically, but it made a difference to him mentally for some reason. And it's just endlessly fascinating to me that details like that are what bring people through something that you can't even imagine you could possibly do. Like, I'm sure he imagined that he could get to Friday, but then that comes and goes. And, I mean, it's hard enough to get there in the first place, but, you know, what do you do then? You know, right. to kind of hit what you think is the bottom and then just go below that and keep going. Yeah, it really requires mental gymnastics. And the other thing I was thinking about is, I imagine that a lot of people, like if you're driving, right, you always have like music or a podcast or something else going on, mm-hmm. you know? Imagine like driving in complete silence. Like, I feel like most people feel like they can't even do that.
Yeah.
And then to kind of think about this situation where you're sitting still and you have to just be, seems super difficult. Like, I don't know.
Incredibly difficult.
Like, can you remember a time where you just kind of sat with your thoughts for more than, I don't know, 10 minutes?
I mean, sometimes
I'm not trying to joke. I'm being serious.
No, I totally know what you mean. I feel like these days, not so much, because we are surrounded by so much media all the time. Sometimes I intentionally try to take a step back and like just be alone with my thoughts. But no, like, yeah, most of the time, no. Like, I really do have something playing most of the time, which is maybe not great. But yeah, being alone with your thoughts is hard sometimes. And for 6 straight days, like, oh my God, yeah. Like for 6 straight days. And also, like, you can't do anything. You can't move. He couldn't even like walk around. Like, he was just kind of sitting on a ledge for 6 days with his thoughts. And not only was he left alone with his thoughts, but he had to control his thoughts and not fall into that really dark place that was 100 feet below him, you know? Like,
right.
He couldn't think about that. And he couldn't, like, he was thinking about get to Friday, but at the same time, he couldn't think about the reality of get to Friday.
Right.
Like, he had to be extremely disciplined in his thoughts at the same time that he was alone with his thoughts. So, yeah. Like, how difficult that must have been. And he did it so well, which is, I think, is why the rituals were so important. And also him, like, carving one letter in the wall at a time, or like singing a song every once in a while. Like, he had to keep himself occupied, but like in a very specific way.
Right.
It's just so interesting to me.
Yeah, I don't know. The only time I really like ever spend time with my thoughts is when we're driving back to your home.
Yeah, like, you know, on a really long road trip.
12-hour drive. And then usually it's when you're sleeping and like I don't end up putting anything on the radio or something.
Sure.
And really the only thing I think of is like Shark Tank ideas.
Yeah.
But that seems to occupy me for hours.
Sure. He comes out of the canyon. He's like, sharks.
Yeah.
I've got a business proposal.
Yeah. I mean,
he's got a very full-fledged business idea.
He's ready to go.
Yeah.
He's on with Aaron Ralston.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Totally.
Because I'm thinking about Gary Vee talking about this. He's like, we're just thinking about all the content that could be made from this.
Right, know? Right.
Content is king.
Yeah. Yeah, I think he did a great job just the whole time. So,
yeah, I totally agreed. And, it, you know, there's no training for it. You know, he just has it.
Yeah. And at the end, he knew when to ask for help and he got the help that he needed. And now he's thriving, which is amazing as well.
Yeah, that was another striking thing. It seemed like he had no hesitation or qualms about asking for help, which I'm sure helped him a lot.
Absolutely, it did. Yeah, it's also inspiring. You know, there's no shame in asking for help when you need it.
Yeah.
Like, why hurt yourself when you can get help, you know?
Well, yeah, but, you know, you feel like you don't need it. You know, you want to be strong for someone else.
Yeah,
I mean, there's a million different reasons why.
So many reasons, but, like, there's also something to be said for, like, when you need help, ask for help, and then you get help and you can move forward.
Yeah.
You know? And he's a really great illustration of that.
Yep.
And I think that's awesome. But, yeah, that was David Ciccatello's story, and I thought he was really inspiring, so I wanted to share it and also remember Lewis. But I think that's all I have to say about that. So why don't we move on to our good thing so we can go on with our days as normal? What is your good thing?
My good thing, I really am typically not a huge follower of the Olympics.
Mm-hmm.
However, I had to watch the hockey teams this year, and Team USA, both the women and the men, brought home gold. And I don't know, I couldn't be happier. I mean, they were both incredible games. Both went to overtime and were both won by Team USA. I mean, it's just, it's awesome. And the fact that the men's team hasn't won since 1980 was like a cherry on top. Like,
totally.
I couldn't believe that. I had just assumed that we had gotten one in between that time. But growing up as a kid playing hockey, I've seen the, you know, quote unquote Miracle on Ice. They made a movie about it like a million times.
Yeah.
It was the movie that we rewatched every time we took a road trip, literally anywhere. So I don't know. It was super cool to see both teams get it in such a dramatic way.
Absolutely.
And I like weirdly know someone who knows someone on the women's team who scored the game winning goal.
So basically, you made the winning goal.
It's correct.
It was.
I would
a
like
really,
to take credit.
Really, really good winning goal. That was the women's winning goal.
Yeah,
rocked.
She like slotted it right under the blocker. And she was like, she had pressure too. So it was really tough to get off. But yeah, that's my good thing. Yeah.
Sure.
I mean, and usually I don't care about the Olympics unless we're in it. So
sure. And you were basically in it. You yourself.
I too. I was. I kind of felt a little bit more in it because I was running. Because I'm training for a run, and I was like listening to the men's gold game or the men's finals while I was running. So I was like, okay, I'm doing something physical.
Yeah,
you know?
That's cool.
Yeah. Oh my God, we should have lost that game though. The men's team should have lost, but their goalie stood on it. I could go on.
That's a good thing.
What is your good thing?
My good thing is maybe the complete opposite, but we got our Girl Scout cookies. Bah, 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 bah. I love Girl Scout cookies. I mean, don't
I mean,
we all?
Tell us your favorite. For me, it has to be a Samoa.
Yeah.
It's the best. It is hard to get through a whole box of Samoas, though, in one sitting.
Well, why would you be doing it in one sitting? Just kidding.
What
I'm
do you
just
mean,
kidding.
Why would you do it in one sitting? You
know, I'm busting your chops.
You're busting my chops. You know that you would do it.
Of course I would.
Yeah.
I've done it.
Yeah. But yeah, it's one of my favorites. And we got a new one. There's some new peanut butter one that you got.
Oh, those aren't new. That's a very, very OG box.
That's an old
box.
One?
Yeah, it's a Do-Si-Do. That's a very OG.
No. Is the oatmeal peanut butter one.
It's Do-Si-Do.
Isn't that new?
No.
No?
OG?
That's not new?
Nope.
What am I thinking of? Tagalong?
Tagalongs are old as well. I stick to the OGs. I don't like the
okay.
I don't like the new ones. I'm a OG Girl Scout girl.
Yeah, you're nostalgia.
Yeah.
I get it. You were a Girl Scout.
I was for
so,
many,
you know.
Many years. I just like the OG cookies. Sue me.
We
I'm a
the
thin
cookie.
Mint myself.
Okay. And do you like them in the freezer?
I mean, it's a pro tip. I like them both ways. I keep one sleeve in the pantry and I keep one sleeve in the freezer.
And
I
one sleeve in the sheets.
And one sleeve in the sheets and one sleeve in my heart. And the other sleeve, don't worry about it. Mind your business.
Hey, it's none ya.
None ya is where the other sleeve is.
None your fucking
okay?
business. All right.
That's my good thing.
Yeah, but it's a good thing.
Anyway, thank you all so much for listening. If you would like to check out all of our bonus episodes, head over to patreon.com/nottodaypodcast. If you or anyone you know has a story of survival or something crazy that's happened to you and you'd like to share with us and possibly hear it on an upcoming listeners episode, send it to notodaypodcast@gmail.com. We post pictures of all the stories we talk about over on Instagram at nottoday_podcast. We have merch over at nottodaypodcast.dashery.com. We have a TikTok that is Not Today Podcast and a Twitter that is Not Today Podcast, but the TN Podcast is a 3.
Because that makes sense.
And just keep breathing.
Yeah.
Yeah.